Negroes, A Place in Nature, Part 3. Van Amringo observes of the Negro race, quote, "Even after having lived for centuries with the white people, from whom they have received every possible instruction, for the purpose of developing an attribute which would be so serviceable to them, as well as those whom they serve, it is very far from having any virtue for which they are distinguished, or even trusted. The Negro is indolent, careless, sensual, tyrannical, predatory, sullen, boisterous, and jovial. Such are the specific characteristics, and the sensual relations are founded upon them. It has been a favourite theory, with some visionary philanthropists, that intermarriages of the different species would be highly favourable to the race, that we have never heard of any of them who is willing to commence the practice in their own families. There is certainly no method that could possibly be devised which would as certainly and as expeditiously degrade the whole human family as amalgamation. If there is any hope for the improvement of the condition of the dark races, the history of mankind shows it can only be founded upon the preservation of the Shemitic or white species. This is the only species endowed with any power to drag the cumbrous dark races out of the slough in which they have been wallowing for ages." Close quote. Burmeister, an excellent observer, says, quote, "I need not enlarge on the long hands, slender fingers, and flat feet of the African. Anyone who has ever visited a menagerie cannot fail to have observed the long hand, slender fingers, long nails, the flat foot, the deficient calf and compressed shank and thigh of the apes, which so much resemble in every respect the peculiarities of the Negro. I have often tried to obtain an insight into the mind of the Negro, but it never was worth the trouble. The only available result obtained was that there is not much mental life in the Negro, and that all his thoughts and actions were merely directed to the lowest requirements of human existence. There is something in the Negro, like the cunning forwardness of the monkey tribe, which renders any familial intercourse, such as we have with a European servant, impossible." Close quote. Carl Voigt has recently observed, quote, "Most of the characters of the Negro, viewed externally, remind us irresistibly of the ape. The short neck, the long lean limbs, the projecting pendulous belly, all this affords a glimmer of the ape beneath the human envelope. Such similitudes are equally detected on examining the structure of the individual parts." Close quote. Mr. Winwood Reed says, quote, "It must be acknowledged that, putting all exceptions aside, the women of Africa are very inferior beings. Their very virtues, with their affections and their industry, are those of well-trained domestic animals. But if the women of Africa are brutal, the men of Africa are feminine. Their faces are smooth. Their breasts are frequently as full as those of European women. Their voices are never gruff or deep. Their fingers are long, and they can be very proud of their rosy nails. While the women are nearly always ill-shaped after their girlhood, the men have gracefully moulded limbs, and always are after a feminine type, the arms rounded, the legs elegantly formed, without too much muscular development, and the feet delicate and small. A king of Ashanti cut off the hands of a slave and bade her scratch his head for vermin with the stumps. If anyone had accused him of barbarity, he would not have understood the accusation. It was his idea of a good, practical joke." It will be understood that the typical Negroes with whom the slavers are supplied represent the dangerous, the destitute, and the diseased classes of African society. They may be compared to those which in England fill our jails, our workhouses, and our hospitals. So far from being equal to us, the polished inhabitants of Europe, as some ignorant people suppose, they are immeasurably below the Africans themselves. The typical Negro is the true savage of Africa, and I must paint the deformed anatomy of his mind, as I have already done that of his body. The typical Negroes dwell in petty tribes where all are equal, except the women, who are slaves, where property is common, and where, consequently, there is no property at all, where one may recognise the utopia of the philosophers, and observe the saddest and basest spectacles which humanity can afford. The typical Negro, unrestrained by moral laws, spends his days in sloth and his nights in debauchery. He smokes hashish till he stupefies his senses or falls into convulsions. He drinks palm wine till he brings on a loathsome disease. He abuses children and stabs the poor brute of a woman whose hands keep him from starvation and makes a trade of his own offspring. He swallows up his youth in premature vice. He lingers through a manhood of disease, and his tardy death is hastened by those who no longer care to find him food. Such are the men and brothers for whom their friends claim not protection but equality. They do not merit to be called our brethren, but let us call them our children. Let us educate them carefully, and in time we may elevate them, not to our own level, that I fear can never be, but to the level of those from whom they have fallen. Close quote. This last remark is made in the supposition that the typical Negro is degenerated from some higher African race, but we think such an hypothesis is not warranted by history, archaeology, or any well-established facts. Mr. Rees's observations were apparently chiefly made on the Gaboon, and his description does not quite agree with the accounts generally given of the Negroes in the Bights or Windward Coast. Mr. Rees's terminology is far from satisfactory. All typical Negroes are Africans, but all Africans are not Negroes. Dr. Van Evry of New York, who has paid considerable attention to the character of the Negro and had ample opportunities for observation, thus describes the Negro. Quote, "But while the analysis of a single bone or of a single feature of the Negro is thus sufficient to demonstrate the specific character or to show the diversity of race, that great fact is still more obviously and with equal certainty revealed in the form, attitude, and other external qualities. The Negro is incapable of an erect or direct perpendicular posture. The general structure of his limbs, the form of the pelvis, the spine, the way the head is set on the shoulders, in short, the tout ensemble of the anatomical formation, forbids an erect position. But while the whole structure is thus adapted to a slightly stooping posture, the head would seem to be the most important agency, for with any other head, or the head of any other race, it would be impossible to retain an upright position at all. But with the broad forehead and small cerebellum of the white man, it is perfectly obvious that the Negro would no longer possess a centre of gravity, and therefore those philanthropic people who would educate him into intellectual equality, or change the mental organism of the Negro, would simply render him incapable of standing on his feet, or of an upright position on any terms. Everyone must have remarked this peculiarity in the form and attitude of the Negro. His head is thrown upwards and backwards, showing a certain, though remote, approximation to the quadrumans, both in its actual formation and the manner in which it is set on his shoulders. The narrow forehead and small cerebrum, the centre of the intellectual powers and the projection of the posterior portion, the centre of the animal functions, render the Negro head radically and widely different from that of the white man. Thus, an anatomist, with the Negro and the orangutan before him, after a careful comparison, would say, perhaps, that nature herself had been puzzled where to place them, and had finally compromised the matter by giving them an exactly equal inclination to the form and attitude of each other." Close quote. Dr. Louis Buchner has drawn a most graphic picture of some of the physical characters of the Negro. Quote, an uninterrupted series of the most various transitions and analogies connect the animal world from the lowest to the highest. Even man, who in his spiritual pride deems himself elevated above the animal creation, is far from forming an exception to this rule. The Ethiopian race connects him by a number of the most striking analogies with the animal world. The long arms, the form of the foot, the thin calf, the long, small hands, the general leanness, the undeveloped nose, the projecting jaw, the low, receding forehead, the small head, the narrow pelvis, the pendulous belly, the deficient beard, the colour of the skin, the disgusting odour, the uncleanliness, the grimaces in talking, the shrieking voice are the many marks which manifestly exhibit the most decided approach of the Negro to the ape. That he also resembles him in his intellectual capacity is sufficiently known and established by the best observers. Close quote. M. Pruner Bay, one of the most eminent of living anthropologists, has written the most complete memoir on the Negro yet published on this subject. Many years ago, he thus expressed himself, respecting the psychological character of the Negro. Quote, the capacity of the Negro is limited to imitation. The prevailing impulse is for sensuality and rest. No sooner are the physical wants satisfied, all psychical effort ceases, and the body abandons itself to sexual gratification and rest. The family relations are weak. The husband or father is quite careless. Jealousy has only carnal motives, and the fidelity of the female is secured by mechanical contrivances. Drunkenness, gambling, sexual gratification, and ornamentation of the body are the most powerful lovers in the life of the Negro. The whole industry is limited to ornaments. Instead of clothing himself, he ornaments his body. Like certain animals, the Negro seems apathetic under pain. The explosions of passion occur when least expected, but are not lasting. The temperament of the Negro has been called choleric, but it is only so to a certain extent. It is a momentary ebullition, followed instantly by perfect apathy. Life has for the Negro no longer any value when he cannot supply the physical wants. He never resists by increased activity, but prefers to die in a state of apathy, or he commits suicide. The Negro has no love for war. He is only driven to it by hunger. War, from passion or destructiveness, is unknown to him. Close quote. This is a sufficiently clear and truthful picture, and the following summary, with which M. Pruner Bay concluded his paper, presented to the Paris Anthropological Society, is equally to be commended for its truth and moderation. Quote, the Negro has always appeared to me as partaking of the nature both of the child and the old man. Anatomists, worthy of our confidence, Jacquard, Serres, and Huchke, have, in this sense, interpreted the details of the anatomy of the Negro. The elongated form of the cranium, the proportions of the cerebral lobes and their respective forms, the prominence of the inferior border of the orbits, the flattened nose, the rounded larynx, the less marked curves of the vertebral column, the lateral compression of the thorax and pelvis, with the vertical direction of the iliac bones, the elongated neck of the uterus, a proportion of the parts composing the extremities, the relative simplicity of the cerebral convolutions, etc., are characteristic features of the Negro race, which are found in the fetus or the infant of the Aryan race, in the different periods of development. The propensity for amusements, for material enjoyments, for imitation and the inconstancy of affection are the appanage of the Negro as well as of our children. The flexosity of the arteries, the flattening of the cornea, the weakness of the muscles, the dragging walk and the early obliteration of the cranial sutures The obstinacy and love of repose are met with in the Negro as in our aged men. In short, the great curve of human development, and its backward direction, appears to be sufficiently extended to appreciate the differences characterizing the Negro race opposed to our race, always taking into account the different characters resulting from adaptation to external conditions. If our interpretation leaves open many gaps, the future may fill them up, perhaps in the same sense. If, finally, the Negro, speaking always figuratively, partakes of the nature of the ape, it must still be admitted that it is not the most ferocious, malicious, nor the most pernicious, but rather the most patient, and frequently the most useful, animal. In any case, an honourable mediocrity is his inheritance. Close quote. The general deductions we would desire to make are: 1. That there is as good a reason for classifying the Negro as a distinct species from the European as there is for making the ass a distinct species from the zebra. And if, in classification, we take intelligence into consideration, there is a far greater difference between the Negro and the European than between the gorilla and the chimpanzee. 2. That the analogies are far more numerous between the Negro and apes than between the European and apes. 3. That the Negro is inferior intellectually to the European. 4. That the Negro is more humanized when in his natural subordination to the European than under any other circumstance. 5. That the Negro race can only be humanized and civilized by Europeans. 6. That European civilization is not suited to the Negro's requirements or character. No man who thoroughly investigates with an unbiased mind can doubt that the Negro belongs to a distinct type. The term species in the present state of science is not satisfactory, but we may safely say that there is in the Negro that assemblage of evidence which would, ipso facto, induce an unbiased observer to make the European and the Negro two distinct types of man. The facts I have quoted, I believe, are sufficient to establish that the Negro is intellectually inferior to the European, and that the analogies are far more numerous between the ape and Negro than between the ape and the European. We shall not enter at length into the three last propositions. Suffice it to say that no subject needs more attention at this minute than the position which the Negro race is fitted to hold in nature. I have said it devolves on the student of the science of man to assign to each race the position which it shall hold. This is truly a momentous and most difficult problem, but one which science must not evade. As a student of mechanical science has given to the world his inductions and discoveries, so must the student of the science of man endeavour to deduce from actual facts principles of guidance for the relations of one race of man to another. It is painful to reflect on the misery which has been inflicted on the Negro race, from the prevailing ignorance of anthropological science, especially as regards the great question of race, by our ignorance of the wants and aspirations of the Negro, and by a mistaken theory respecting his origin, this country has been the means of inflicting a prodigious and at present totally unknown amount of mischief on these people. Our Bristol and Liverpool merchants perhaps helped to benefit the race when they transplanted some of them to America, and our mistaken legislature has done the Negro race much injury by their absurd and unwarrantable attempts to prevent Africa from exporting her worthless or surplus population. All this has been done on a theoretical assumption of a mental equality of the different races or species of man. In an attempt to benefit the Negro, we have brought on him endless misery and rendered some of the most beautiful and productive islands in the world of little more use to humanity at large than they were before the discovery of Columbus. But men, wedded to a theory, become blind to all facts and will learn nothing from experience. all the millions of money which have been spent, and which expenditure has inflicted great hardships on our own working classes, might have been saved had we taken the trouble to investigate the character of the Negro race. Scientific men have yet to do their duty in showing what are the facts. It may be said that some of the propositions I have advanced are in favour of the slave trade. Such, however, is not my own interpretation of these propositions. No one can be more conscious of the horrors of the slave trade as conducted at this time. Nothing can be worse for Africa generally than the continual capture of innocent men and women by brutal Europeans. Few things can be more horrible than the manner in which it is attempted to carry these people across the Atlantic. Nay, more, nothing can be more unjust than to sell any man, woman, or child into slavery, as understood by the Greeks and Romans, where the life of the slave was absolutely at the disposal of the master, whenever his caprice or fancy thought fit to take it. We protest against being put forward as advocating such views. But while I say this, I cannot shut my eyes to the fact that slavery, as understood by the ancients, does not exist out of Africa, and that the highest type of the Negro race is at present to be found in the Confederate States of America, far superior in intelligence and physique to both his brethren in Africa and to his free brethren in the Federal States. Nowhere does the Negro attain to such a long life as in the Confederate States. And this law, formerly obtained in the West India Islands before our mistaken interference. Nowhere does the Negro character shine so highly as it does in his childish and fond attachment to his master and his family. The Negro cares far more for his master and mistress than he does for his own children after they are a few years old. I by no means join in that indiscriminate abuse of the Negro character which has been indulged in, especially by those who have only seen the Negro in his savage state, or the emancipated, from work that is, in the West India Islands. On the contrary, there is much that is to be admired, and more that is useful in the Negro when properly and kindly treated. Brutal masters there are in every part of the world, but we must not found a law on exceptions. Scientific men, therefore, dare not close their eyes to the clear facts as to the improvement in mind and body, as well as the general happiness which is seen in those parts of the world in which the Negro is working in his natural subordination to the European. In some respects, the Negro is certainly not only not inferior, but even far superior to the European. If, for instance, the European were alone in the Confederate States of America, these fertile regions would soon become a barren waste. The Negro is there able to work with impunity, and does himself and the world generally much good by his labour. Occupations and diseases, which are fatal to the Europeans, are quite harmless to the Negro. By their juxtaposition in this part of the world, they confer a material benefit on each other. But it may be asked, why remove the Negro from his own country? Why not humanize him in Africa? No doubt this sounds very feasible, and no pains should be spared to introduce every possible humanizing influence into Africa. There is little doubt that the African is much easier humanized out of his native land, away from all his savage associations. But this need not prevent us from doing all we can towards civilizing him in his own country. It has been affirmed on the best authority, although frequently denied, that domestic slaves are only sold in Africa for some crime. No one, we presume, will dare assert that there are no criminals in Africa. What shall we do with our criminals may be a problem which is occupying the attention of the political economist of Africa, like His Majesty the King of Dahomey, as well as the government of Great Britain. Is Africa not to be allowed to export her criminals? Or are they so worthless and unmanageable that no people will have them? What is to be done with unruly or criminal slaves? As a king of old Calabar said, "You bind me down not to sell them. Tell me it is wrong to kill them. What must I do with them? I will give you some, and then you won't take them." Would it not be well to allow a regular export of the surplus population, instead of permitting and indeed encouraging the butcheries of the so-called king of Dahomey? The difficulties of humanizing, much less of civilizing, the Negro in his own country are very great. Yet, if such healthy sentiments were generally diffused in this country, as have been lately published in an admirable work entitled Wanderings in West Africa, it is impossible to say what great results might in time be obtained. This author well says, quote, "Ever remember that by far the greater number of the liberated were the vilest of criminals in their own lands, and that in their case exportation becomes, in fact, the African form of transportation." Close quote. There is abundant evidence to show that the Negro will not work without a considerable amount of persuasion. Even Dr. R. Clarke is obliged to admit that the Creoles of Sierra Leone, quote, "manifest the utmost contempt for agricultural pursuits, and the same feeling seems to actuate the half-educated, liberated African lads." Close quote. Another writer observes that in Sierra Leone, the Christian tenderness of the British government has tended to demoralize them. The women have become as vicious as those of Egypt, the basest of kingdoms, worse than the men, bad as they are. Theft is carried to such an extent that no improvement is possible at Freetown. I have stated that one of the results of my inquiry leads me to believe that English institutions are not suited to the Negro race. There seems to be a maximum testimony to show that the liberated and the Creoles in our colonies are a perfectly worthless set. They accept all the vices of our civilization with none of its duties. A recent public writer, on behalf of the English colonies on the west coast of Africa, well says, quote, "The African is far more innocent and natural a creature when he has never been brought within the range of civilized life. The liberated Africans are far superior to the rising generation in energy, in talent, and in honest principles. To handle a hoe has now become a disgrace, and the people have lost their manhood by becoming gentlemen. Only the ignorant can boast of the extensive freedom we have given the African. Freedom, indeed, we should have given, but it ought to have been qualified to suit their capacities." Close quote. In now bringing my remarks to a close, I cannot, perhaps, do better than quote the graphic picture of the present state of Africa, which has been only published during these last few weeks. There is much true science and healthy manhood in these sentiments. The work of which I speak is evidently the work of a man who has devoted much attention to the study of the great science of mankind. And I am pleased to find that my own views find ample support in the conclusions of this accomplished and scientific observer. Speaking of the Negroes of Bonny, he says, quote, "The slaves were a truly miserable appearance, lean and deformed, with a cracker lepra and fearful ulcerations. It is in these places that one begins to feel a doubt touching the total suppression of slavery. The chiefs openly beg that the rules may be relaxed in order that they may get rid of their criminals. This is at present impossible, and the effects are a reduplication of misery. We pamper our convicts, Africans torture them to death. Cheapness of the human article is another cause of immense misery to it. In some rivers, a canoe crew never lasts 3 years. Pilfering, Show me a black man and I will show you a thief, say the traders. And debauchery are natural to the slave, and they must be repressed by abominable cruelties. The master thinks nothing of nailing their hands to a water cask, of mutilating them in various ways. Many lose their eyes by being peppered, after the East Indian fashion, with coarsely powdered cayenne. Their ears are cut off, or they are flogged. The whip is composed of a twisted bullock's or hippopotamus's hide, sun-dried, with a sharp edge at the turns, and often wrapped with copper wire. It is less merciful, even, than the knout, now historical. The operation may be prolonged for hours, or for a whole day, the culprit's arms being tied to a rafter, which keeps them at full stretch, and every 15 minutes or so a whack that cuts away the flesh like a knife is administered. This is a favourite treatment for guilty wives, who are also ripped up, cut to pieces, or thrown to the sharks. If a woman has twins, or becomes mother of more than four, the parent is banished and the children are destroyed. The greatest insult is to point at a man with arm and two fingers extended, saying at the same, Namashubra, i.e. one of twins, or a son of some lower animal. When a great man dies, all kinds of barbarities are committed. Slaves are buried, or floated down the river, bound to bamboo sticks and mats, till eaten piecemeal by the sharks. The slave, as might be expected, is not less brutal than his lord. It amazes me to hear Englishmen plead that there is moral degradation to a negro, bought by a white man, and none when serving under a black man. The philanthropists, doubtless, think how our poorer classes at home, in the 19th century, would feel if hurried from liberty to eternal servitude by some nefarious African. But can any civilized sentiments belong to the miserable half-starved being whose one scanty meal of vegetable per day is eked out with monkey and snake, cat and dog, maggot and grub, whose life is ceaseless toil, varied only by torture, and who may be destroyed at any moment by a nod from his owner? When the slave once surmounted his dread of being shipped by the white man, nothing under the sun would, I believe, induce him willingly to return to what he should call his home. And, as they were, our West Indian colonies were lands of happiness compared with oil rivers. As for the southern states, the slave's lot is paradise, when succeeding what he endures on the west coast of Africa. I believe these to be facts, but tant pis pour la fée. Presently, however, the philanthropic theory shall fall, and shall be replaced by a new fabric built upon a more solid foundation. Close quote. Finally, let me observe that it is not alone the man of science who has discerned the Negro's unfitness for civilization as we understand it. Here is the opinion of Mr. Anthony Trollope, who is certainly quite guiltless of ever having examined the evidence on the distinction of the Negro and the European, and yet truly he says of the Negroes, quote, "Give them their liberty, starting them well in the world, at what expense you please, and at the end of 6 months they will come back upon your hands for the means of support. Everything must be done for them. They expect food, clothes, and instruction, as to every simple act of life, as do children." Close quote. We must, for the present, leave alone all questions as to the origin of the Negro, and simply take him as he exists, and not as poets or fanatics paint him. We shall then learn that it is only by observation and experiment that we can determine the exact place in nature which the Negro race should hold, and that it is both absurd and chimerical to attempt to put him in any other.